Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to WrestleMania!
Hello everyone, it's Jack, a very tired Jack from Cultaholic Wrestling, because there's been so much of the wrestling, hasn't there? So this is not a Matches of the Month per se, but a Matches of WrestleMania Week special. Long-time listeners to this series will know that I did one of these last year, and it's very exciting times indeed. Last year's Mania provided this podcast with my favourite match of 2023. So I'm really looking forward to this one and to talk about all the wrestling that I saw. And it was a lot of wrestling over the course of Mania Week, Mania 40 Week. And yes, we have a lot to talk about. It's also worth noting just before I begin that several highly recommended matches have already happened around the wrestling world in the month of April so far, even though it's still a very young month. Those matches that took place will be covered in my usual Best Matches of April episode, which I got, at the end of the month. But in this episode, we are looking at WrestleMania Weekend, or as it's sort of gradually expanded to over the years, WrestleMania Week. Before we really get into it, it only feels right to talk briefly about the big result. Last year, I talked on this very podcast about how weird and infuriating a decision it was to have Cody Rhodes lose to Roman Reigns, and how I really hoped that he knew he was going to lose well in advance and hadn't just found out on the night or the weekend itself. A lot of people at the time were saying it would all be worth it and that Cody losing was the right decision if he then won at Mania 40. And I doubted it. I thought that WWE wouldn't be able to manufacture a moment that would have been a bigger deal than last year. And I was wrong. And although I do sort of think they half lucked into it with the involvement of The Rock, you know, accidentally giving Cody the chance to get this organic second wind as this massive screwed over babyface. While I do think they kind of looked into it, as I say, I do also think that Cody Rhodes himself totally earned and deserved this moment. But how good was that match itself and all the other matches? And what were the best matches across Mania Weekend? Let's dive in and let's start with WrestleMania 40, Night 1.
What a way to kick off the main event here tonight at WrestleMania. There are 72,543. WWE fans here tonight in Philadelphia, sold out at the Link. This is the biggest tag team match in the history of WrestleMania. Seth Rollins will main event WrestleMania for the first time in his career. Seth Rollins is also the man that, well, beat Roman Reigns via disqualification a couple of years ago, still holds that in his back pocket. Cody Rhodes, who tomorrow night has the main event against Roman Reigns for the championship, understands a win here tonight evens the playing field. For The Rock and Roman, teaming together for the very first time in their careers, understand a win for them means that Bloodline rolls tomorrow night. Let's get it on at WrestleMania!
I think now that Night 2 has happened, and it's all said and done and it's all in the books, history might shine a lot more kindly on the main event of Night 1 than it did for that brief window, that brief 24-hour period, or just less than, between the end of Night 1 and the beginning of Night 2. I've seen this main event of Night 1 be quite a divisive one online. One camp seeming to suggest that it was too long, too slow, and ultimately a big letdown as a WrestleMania main event. And the other side of things, the other camp pointing out, very helpfully, thank you, that assuming Cody's going to win at the end of night two, we needed this big loss for the babyfaces before the ultimate moment of triumph to close the weekend. And that's exactly what happened, of course. Cody did overcome even further odds, the Bloodline rules, to win in the end. Unfortunately, with regards to night one's main event, I am in that first camp. I found it very slow. I found it very tedious. It didn't help that it was like 4 a.m. over here in the UK. But I think that even if I was more well-rested, it would have still felt like a bit of a slog. And I do partly agree with the other side of the argument that having Cody seem even more vulnerable at the end of night one could be used to make his eventual victory all the more dramatic. But I don't know if that fully excuses the way that the night one main event panned out. Like, did it have to be so ponderous? And that's just my opinion. I know some people, I saw a lot of people really enjoyed it online. I couldn't, you know, I've only got my own opinion, and I couldn't really bring myself to enjoy the match. As massive and star-studded as it was, and as big a deal as it was to be The Rock's first match since Mania 32, that match, of course, lasted only a few seconds. This one lasted a bit longer. I think maybe my expectations for the match were artificially raised somewhat by the stuff that we saw on TV and the build-up. You know, all those excellent segments, The Rock beating Cody down in the rain, that really wild brawl at the end of one episode as well. I think I was expecting this match itself to have a bit of that wildness about it. Obviously, we couldn't expect The Rock to go flat out 100 miles an hour for a prolonged period of time. That would be ridiculous. But I thought there'd at least be elements of wildness, if that makes sense. But yeah, instead, I did find it really slow and flat, and I don't think that it did that much to kind of justify its extreme length. I think it was the second longest WrestleMania match ever, behind only Bret and Shawn at Mania 12. Obviously, I can sort of forgive that now, looking back, because of the end of Night 2, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. But yeah, as a match on its own, sadly, I didn't really think much of The Rock and Roman versus Cody and Seth. I think my favourite match of Night 1 was probably Sami Zayn versus Gunther for the IC title. In fact, no, not probably. It definitely was Sami Zayn versus Gunther. I do have mixed feelings on this one in terms of the booking. I think it might have caused me to fall into that classic wrestling fan trap where I'd envisioned in my head exactly where I wanted this to go. Then I had to stop myself feeling disappointed when it didn't go exactly as I'd planned it in my brain. I wasn't the only one. I was one of quite a lot of people thinking that it would be best, it would be most compelling if Gunther won the match, because Sami, when on the cusp of being about to beat Gunther, had that victory snatched from him by the interference of Chad Gable, either by, like, you know, pulling the ref out or whatever at the critical moment. I think that would have been an unbelievable storyline. The jealousy of Chad, you know, not wanting someone else to be the one to beat Gunther because he thought it should be him and everything. But as a match and a storyline on its own merit, though, the way it did actually pan out, I still thought it was really good emotional stuff. I do partly still disagree with Sami being the guy to beat Gunther. I think there would have been at least two other superstars who would have made a more compelling story in beating Gunther for the IC title. Chad Gable himself, as I've mentioned, and possibly a returning Sheamus as well. And I do hope that Sheamus returns soon. At the time of recording, he hasn't quite yet, but we did get a video package suggesting that he might. However, I think that Sami, as the valiant underdog babyface in a storyline, that's never a bad idea, is it? It's always going to come off quite well. He's an absolute natural in this position, as he proved last year in that feud with Roman Reigns, and as he's proven now countless times over the course of his very, very illustrious career. The match itself, I thought, was very good. Maybe not as good as some other Gunther title matches, especially the triple threat at last year's Mania, which, of course, was my absolute favourite match of 2023. But that's a very high bar to live up to, isn't it? That triple threat last year. And while I don't think this was quite as good, it was still very good. Sami taking all kinds of punishment before coming back to win. Traditional, simple storytelling, but the match itself had some incredible feats. Not just the punishment dished out by Gunther, but the punishment dished out to Gunther, specifically that top turnbuckle brainbuster in the final stretch, which was honestly kind of awe-inspiring. I've seen Sami do that move before. I can't think of another time I've seen him do it on somebody the size of Gunther. and it was very, very effective indeed. And maybe my second favourite match of Night 1, although I wasn't a huge fan of Night 1 overall, but this match deserves a lot of credit too. The opener, Becky Lynch versus Rhea Ripley for the Women's World Championship. I thought it was a good match, a good title match, and a good choice to open the show as well. But I think it especially deserves a bit of praise because of the difficulties that both women overcame. Obviously, it's since emerged in the aftermath of the event that Becky Lynch wasn't feeling her best heading into it physically. I think she had some sort of illness. And full credit to her for plowing through and, you know, putting on a match where you honestly couldn't really tell. She was still her fiery, energetic self somehow. Because, well, when I'm ill, I don't want to get out of bed. So I don't know how she, you know, got herself up for that match. Rhea Ripley has since revealed as well that she suffered a panic attack shortly before the match was scheduled to take place. So, yeah, Becky wasn't feeling her best physically. Rhea wasn't feeling her best mentally or physically. I suppose a panic attack's not great physically either. So full credit to both women for pulling through and putting on a match where I don't think anyone could really tell. Rhea winning was obviously the right decision. I can't wait to see what she does next. Her star continues to rise. She becomes more and more impressive with every showing. And Becky, I think, probably deserves a break, but I don't know if she'll have one. Seems like Roman's going to have one and Seth's going to have one. And I think Becky probably deserves a bit of a break as well. Not just to give other stars a chance to come through and shine in a slightly more elevated position on the card, but also just because they deserve a rest as well. But yeah, that was Night 1. That was kind of my two favourite matches of Night 1 and the main event, which I couldn't not talk about, even though I didn't particularly enjoy it. But now we have to talk about Night 2, which was, in my opinion, far superior. Many people's opinion. I'm not a radical for saying that, but far, far superior. And isn't it a bit weird, right, that WrestleMania 2 was so clearly superior to Night 1? Because on paper, I thought Night 1 looked loads better. But Night 2 turned out to be the clear winner, and I think it would have even been without the considerable bonus of the aftermath, the closing scenes of the show, which gave Night 2 a boost that I don't think it even really needed. I just thought it was a much stronger show top to bottom than Night 1 was. Anyway, I'll save the main event for the end. Let's begin at the beginning of the night with the beginning. Drew McIntyre versus Seth Rollins for the World Heavyweight Championship. I loved this match. I saw some people saying that it was finisher spam, but I think even if that is true, and it might have been very slightly guilty of being finisher spam-esque, but even so, I think that totally worked in the context of the surrounding storyline. Drew, you know, by this point in the match, or by this point in the feud, excuse me, realizes that Seth is a severely weakened and broken champion. So Drew wants to get this over with as quickly as possible and as brutally as possible, which explains the instant claymore and all the frantic nature of his attacks and everything. Seth, for his part, also probably wants to get the match over with quickly, because the last thing he would want in character is this turning into a long and grueling slog, because his body might not be able to take it after such a long and difficult title reign. And of course, after the main event of Night 1. So I really don't think this did feel rushed or particularly spammy, if that's the right word. I don't think it felt like that at all. I thought it was very deliberately wrestled at a quick, frantic pace, and I think that helped make it a really exciting contest. Personally, I bit hard on a lot of the near falls, and even though I was kind of three quarters confident that Drew was going to win, they had me doubting my own prediction at several points in the match. And I thought then the cherry on top was the aftermath, which is all really good stuff as well. You know, CM Punk. Well, Drew, first of all, it was kind of Drew's fault, I suppose, what happened to him. It was Punk's fault, but it was kind of Drew's fault. Like, Drew celebrating with his family, very emotional. Seth even pays tribute to him before walking off up the ramp. And then, obviously, Drew can't help himself getting CM Punk's face on guest commentary. Punk beats Drew down with his cast or his arm brace. And it leads to Damian Priest cashing in. And I think that that is a bit of a booking masterstroke, actually. It drives both Punk and Drew's character motivation forward. Punk as this vindictive asshole, but one that we can't help but cheer for. I am recording this before Dynamite, which apparently is going to see the airing of the footage of the fight at All In at Wembley. But if I'm still allowed to be a CM Punk fan after that, then yeah, I can't wait to see what happens, and I can't help but cheer him, even if he is being, as I've said, this vindictive asshole to Drew. On Drew's part, his character is getting his comeuppance, and it's kind of, as I've said, all his fault. After all, he's complaining about wanting justice and being screwed over, and then the merciless trolling of Punk after injuring him, and it all came back to bite him. I think that's a wonderful little story, or the start of a new story, perhaps. Just really nice, layered stuff, at least as far as we can expect from pro wrestling. I'm not saying it's Shakespeare or anything, but it is a great wrestling storyline. Another match I want to mention, and one that took me by surprise, is the US title triple threat, Logan Paul versus Randy Orton versus Kevin Owens. I'm surprised how much I like this one. And I need to stop being surprised whenever a Logan Paul match is good. He is just good, isn't he? He's a good wrestler, as bizarre as it still feels to say that. And the more I think about it, the more we should have realized this match would be a good one ahead of time. Not only is Logan far better than he has any right to be somehow, but he was marshalled through this match by two absolute greats in Owens and Orton. Randy Orton is the king, isn't he, of this kind of slowed down, methodical storytelling style in the ring, this sports entertainy style. And Kevin Owens, even though he traditionally has been seen as more of this indie style work rate guy, he can also be this reliable hand to guide someone through a match if they maybe need a bit of a helping hand, like he proved with an aging Steve Austin at WrestleMania. Obviously, the guy in the prime bottle was Eyeshow Speed, who I have heard of, but I'm not too familiar with because I am now in my early 30s. But Speed, from what I've seen, seems to be an energetic young man. And while I'm not sure his appearance might have been as cool or shocking to wrestling fans as WWE might have liked, it probably did mean a lot to the very casual or mainstream fans, or even, you know, the children watching, which wrestling is still for at its heart. I know that's hypocritical of me to say with my very serious podcast about how good the wrestling is, but wrestling is also for the children. And sometimes when we're reminded of that, we are also reminded that we're all idiots for taking it so seriously. It is still fun to take it seriously, though. Well, in my opinion. Anyway, I thought Speed stuff all went down pretty well. He took the RKO well on the announce table, and the finish of the match made total sense too, with Logan weaseling his way out with the US title still intact, taking advantage and kind of stealing the pinfall from Randy Orton. So yeah, no complaints here at all. I quite enjoyed it, and I thought all three guys did really good character work. In fact, before I move on to the next match, one bit I particularly enjoyed was the forced miscommunication between the two babyfaces by Logan when he shoved one into the other, and then they just kind of subverted the usual trope. Because usually in wrestling, obviously, the two allies would be like, "Whoa, you just pushed me," and wouldn't realize. But in this instance, they did realize. They quickly went, "Oh, he pushed me into you," and then the other one went, "Oh, fair enough," and then they just beat him down. I thought that was brilliant. Anyway, I think this next match was the penultimate match of night two. Io Sky defending the WWE Women's Championship against Bayley, which wasn't the most spectacular match across WrestleMania week by any stretch of the imagination, but one of the, I think, stronger emotional stories told via a match of the week. This was really well done by both women, putting an exclamation point on the overall story, kind of similar, not in terms of the style of the match, but similar in terms of the story it was trying to tell to Sami versus Gunther in that regard. And it had the added emotional bonus as well of Bayley finally getting this big WrestleMania moment that she fully deserves. I know that Bayley's had several WrestleMania wins before. You know, I saw one in person, Mania 33 in Orlando, Florida, 2017. And it felt like one of the less heralded matches on the card, to be honest. And it was a shame for Bayley because even though she won in, I think it was like a four-way elimination match, even though she won, I think it was for the Raw Women's Championship, it was barely an afterthought. Like, once all was said and done and the Hardy Boys had come back and Taker might have retired after losing to Roman. Yeah, this was much more what Bayley deserves, even though she only beat one opponent rather than three, as she did at WrestleMania 33. This felt far more significant this year, and a long overdue recognition of what an asset she's been to WWE over the years, through her years in NXT, coming up to the main roster, turning heel, the pandemic years as well. Everything she's done, you can tell she's given her absolute all to, and this was kind of the moment in the sun that I think Bayley fully deserved. I've always been kind of sad that Bayley, well, she wasn't in the main event of WrestleMania 35, was she? That was Charlotte, Becky and Ronda. Her and Sasha never got to have a match of the same length and quality as they did in NXT. And I always wondered, oh no, is Bayley going to be like the forgotten woman of the four horsewomen? You know, Charlotte is the strongest booked. Becky is the one who's had this massive babyface run. Sasha is like the indie favourite. She's probably the best worker of the four. And now she's off doing her own thing. That's kind of made her a different type of star. And I thought, is Bayley going to be the one left behind? Especially because, you know, I think probably that Sasha's the best of the four in-ring. Becky's, you know, probably the best character with the most star quality. Charlotte's the best heel. But Bayley kind of is an all-rounder. And you could even argue, you know, I wouldn't disagree necessarily with anyone who says she's as good as Sasha, if not maybe better at some aspects in the ring as well, or better than the other three at certain aspects on the mic. Bayley is kind of the most versatile of the four, I think you could say. And I think this was long overdue. And I'm very glad she got this moment. Can't wait to see what she does with her title reign, however long it may last. And I'm just looking forward to seeing her have more excellent matches and feuds and promos going ahead. Io was great too for her part. She played a great beaten villain. But yeah, this was Bayley's moment. Io carried the match as a heel and hit some lovely moonsaults and you know, beat down Bayley. But when she had to lose, she lost hard. And that's what everyone wanted. We wanted to see Bayley triumph. And she did. Right then, Roman versus Cody. So, despite night one, in my view, not being a total success, or at least not winning everybody over, all they still had to do at the end of night two was just send us home. Going to use a baseball analogy now, if you'll forgive me, as an Englishman. But from what I understand, and I've been watching a bit of baseball, I'm a Chicago Cubs guy. Go Cubs, go. This is the situation that I could see this as in if it was a baseball game, right? Bases loaded, bottom of the ninth, zero outs, plenty of chances for the batting team to drive in the winning run. You only need one run, by the way. I forgot to mention that. Scores are tied. And even though I don't think WWE maybe hit a grand slam, I think maybe they cleared the bases. You know, it was like a three-run hit rather than a grand slam. It was a base-clearing triple, let's say that. Because even though it got the job done, and I really enjoyed the result, I didn't agree with absolutely everything. It felt just a little bit short of storytelling perfection, which they'd built themselves so close to, by the way. So they deserved quite an easy task here at the end of night two. The only thing that I didn't really enjoy, I'll start with the negative, then I'll talk about the positives. But the only thing I didn't really enjoy that stopped it from being a total grand slam was The Undertaker. Like, why The Undertaker? Do you know what I mean? I've seen people online suggest, because in the build-up, everyone was saying, Rock's going to come out, Austin's going to stop him. And I've seen people online suggesting that if it was going to be Austin, which was the rumor, that would have been too much. That if Austin had taken care of The Rock, it would have overshadowed Cody's win and made people desperate to see Rock Austin fall. And Austin might not want to do that. And I don't necessarily agree. Well, people probably would have wanted Rock Austin 4. I do agree with that bit. But I don't agree with the other bit, that it would have overshadowed Cody's moment. Because I think if Austin had come out, stunned Rock, and then gone, I think people would have still been really excited for Cody. I think it would have just driven the excitement even higher. I do think Taker felt like an odd choice. But to be fair, all the other bells and whistles I really enjoyed, as did lots of people from what I've seen online. You know, the Usos' involvement and the spear off the ramp from Jimmy to Jay, that was excellent. The repeat of the solo interference from last year, but this time Cody was able to kick out, that was excellent. Then we've all seen it, Cena, then The Rock, Taker, I guess, got involved as well. Oh, before that as well, the Rollins stuff. When that happened, when he kind of crawled into the ring with the chair and Roman just punched him out immediately, We all laughed at that watching in the office. But in hindsight, it did turn out to make sense. Rollins just being so broken down by the exploits of the night before and his whole title run. And then Roman obviously deciding to get revenge on Rollins and remain bitter about the breakup of the Shield all those years ago, which gave Cody a bit of extra time to recover and avoid that last spear and then go into the finishing stretch. That was excellent as well. You know, normally I enjoy matches that are excellent within the framework of a story and are top-notch super work rate matches as well, you know. If they fulfill both those criteria, it's probably going to get in my top 10, if not top 5, at the end of the year. This match was a good match, but, you know, in terms of the storyline and where it fit, that's what it was all about, really. It wasn't so much about the work necessarily. It was about where they took the story, which is very Triple H, isn't it? They did it perfectly, or nearly perfectly, as I've said. The Undertaker bit was a bit strange, but they did it nearly perfectly. And you could argue that it was just an easy task once they built it up to that stage, but you do have to give WWE credit for building it up to that stage in the first place. But it was very emotional afterwards, wasn't it? The scenes were incredible. Before I get onto that bit, the work that Roman and Cody did in the match before all the interference was very solid as well. Even though I've said it was more about the bells and whistles than the work, the foundation was very much laid in the match preceding all the extra stuff. Obviously, they kept it quite simple, but it was all very exciting as well. The little crowd brawl was a great visual with Cody standing tall amongst the people. I loved the fact that they hit each other's finishers and survived them as well. Not that innovative, but you don't see it too often in WWE, so it's always effective when they bust that out. And obviously, Cody's win will go down, rightly so, as one of the all-time WrestleMania moments. And whenever you can do something that stands out in a show that has gone on for 40 years, then you've done pretty well. So, and this was undoubtedly an all-time WrestleMania moment. I think also the aftermath is its own all-time WrestleMania moment, to be honest. Part of me, and I think part of all of us, is quite cynical. Clearly, WWE is desperate to try and move away from the Vince McMahon allegations and try to make itself look kind of squeaky clean in the process. But I think as fans viewing the product, this ending also, if we maintain a healthy bit of cynicism, we can also look at it and admit that it also gave us plenty of cause for optimism. Triple H seems far more tuned in with what large portions of the fan base want than Vince has been for 20 plus years now. With the odd exception, you know, there was the CM Punk stuff initially, there was the Daniel Bryan stuff initially, but the wrestlers themselves really had to do a lot of the heavy lifting, didn't they? And force their way through against a lot of obstacles, seemingly deliberately put in their way by management. And the Triple H, generally, and this is from an outside view, but I'm guessing, and it very much seems to be the case, generally it seems like a more positive, collaborative storytelling sort of environment, doesn't it? Where Triple H is eager to celebrate the strengths of those in his roster rather than, you know, de-pushing people for trying to get over. Like I say, the aftermath did seem deliberately engineered to seem like the start of a new era. They were saying it enough on commentary throughout the night and everything. Stephanie said it at the top of the second night too. But even though it was very deliberately engineered, that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't also true. I think this is very much the start of a new era. And as I said on Twitter after the main event, if WWE are looking for an ambassador to represent the company as best it can, Cody Rhodes is the perfect guy for the job. Yeah, I don't know what else to really say on it. I really mean that as well. Like, he is, I mean, look at the support he's managed to get over the past year or two. It's not a common occurrence. And the way he carries himself, the way he treats people, the way he speaks publicly, yeah, he ticks all the boxes. So congrats to him. And congrats to Triple H, I suppose, because it's looking very positive for WWE. So that was WrestleMania Night 1, which I wasn't too big a fan of, and Night 2, which I was a big fan of. But obviously WrestleMania week isn't just WrestleMania, guys. There's a lot of other shows as well. But I think the next step we'll take in this episode will be just a little short hop. Not out into the wilderness just yet, but we're going to head to NXT. Still under the WWE umbrella, but it's risky out there. You'd better get ready to...
Might be looking for nothing but neck. gets countered, gets caught, able to counter right back around. A nice jumping neck breaker by Trick Williams. Poison Rana, followed by Pop Rocks. And Perez transitions into another cross face. Looking for high risk, but there's Briggs. And what's on Briggs' mind?
What the? You got to be kidding me.
Dragunov.
Yeah, Stand and Deliver was a great show. I watched it with Ross on Twitch, twitch.tv/cultaholic. We did our live reactions with a very enthusiastic Twitch chat, quite a raucous Twitch chat actually, and we had a ball, we had a whale of a time. But once I'd calmed down and rewatched the show, it was still good, it still held up. It wasn't just because I was watching it with Ross and we were getting really excited and everything. It was a genuinely good show, and it continues this trend of NXT specials or PLEs being almost a different promotion to what NXT is usually like on a weekly basis. This weird fever dream mishmash of weird half storyline ideas and stereotypical gimmicks that are very one note, like the cheerleader, the mean girl, the milkman, but then the PLEs come along and everyone's wrestling their socks off and it's really entertaining. And that's what happened here. I'll give a brief mention to the main event, which I didn't think was bad, but was strange. So the main event obviously was Trick Williams versus Carmelo Hayes, this grudge match, this blood feud. It had been built up just so much. And then they had a good match, but not the one that I think people felt was advertised or was hinted at. I actually think I'm kinder personally on the match. My opinion of it seems to generally be higher than the consensus online. Because I don't think there was anything wrong with it as a match in a vacuum. But obviously no matches in a vacuum, and this was the main event of the biggest NXT show of the year. And after it had been given so much attention on TV, and these video packages, and main roster superstars being drafted into the video packages to say, well, this is one of the biggest rivalries I've ever seen, and all these excellent segments on TV, which is usually quite ropey, but the segments involving Trick and Mello usually always delivered. After all that, and after being really built up as like the biggest thing in NXT since like Gargano and Ciampa's feud, you felt like that sort of treatment is reserved for something really special. And then they went out and had quite a standard match, and I'm not sure why. Like, would it have been a surprise? Picture that match, right? Copy and paste it in your mind into just like the main event of a weekly episode of NXT. And it wouldn't be weird. It wouldn't feel overblown or too good for that show. It would just fit nicely. So it was weird that it was the main event and it had been built up to such a degree. And by the way, I want to make it very clear. I'm not blaming Mello or Trick at all. I'm a huge fan of both guys. I just have to question the booking. Especially after such great work from both men in the build. I think they deserve to have a lot more faith put in them by NXT. Maybe it would have benefited from some sort of unsanctioned stipulation, something to raise the stakes, maybe I quit or something. Or if not, certainly it should have had a longer time slot. I don't know really what the aim was here or why they kept it so simple. But there were some very good matches on the show to talk about too. Oh my God, let's talk about Obafemi defending his North American title in a triple threat against Dijak and Josh Briggs. Or as I've seen people christen it, call the police too. I'm not sure who coined that term. I saw someone in our Twitch chat call it that at the time. I think I've since seen someone on Twitter call it that. It could well have been the same person, which could well be possible because everyone who watched this match could tell that it was a worthy successor to Sheamus, Gunther and Drew from last year. So if an army of people were calling it call the police too, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised at that. And the reason that everyone says it's like a successor to that match from WrestleMania 39 is because it was three big lads throwing absolutely everything at each other in like a truly breathless contest. Big moment after big moment after big moment. It really felt like they went out to steal the show here. And honestly, they did. They absolutely stole the show. Coming out of a WrestleMania weekend, I don't know if you necessarily expect like the second match on the NXT card to be one of the best, most universally critically acclaimed matches of this entire wrestling festival bonanza. Like, I don't know if necessarily we would have expected this, but it was absolutely the case. People online who never watch NXT were saying stuff like, what the hell is this match? These guys are throwing everything at each other. And even if everything else on the night at Stand and Deliver had gone just about as well as it could have done, this would still have been up there. It would have maybe been like, you would still only have expected it to be like the third or fourth best match on the show. But it would still have been the best match on the show, even if everything had gone perfectly, because it was that good. It was absolutely the best thing on the show. And I don't even think it's particularly close. And that's not saying that there weren't other good matches on the card. This was just so obviously an excellent match. Obafemi, right? Like, all three guys were brilliant. Obafemi, right? His future is frightening. He's got, in the Triple H era, it doesn't matter as much, but he's got the size and he's got the charisma and he's got the look and the presence and the aura and the, and that sort of intangible star quality about him. And instantly, right, we could tell that he had all those things just by looking at him, just by hearing his first few promos, just by watching his first few squash matches or very short dominant performances. Now we're starting to learn that he can go like this as well, that he can really, really wrestle. And he doesn't even need to be able to. He's got all the things. He's got all the things he needs already that mean you don't need to be able to wrestle at the level of the super workers. But he's this good already. That's frightening, man. I don't know what's going to happen with him, but I genuinely wouldn't be surprised if we're looking at a future world champion. He is unbelievable. And I'm so excited to see what happens. Dijak's great, we all know that. Josh Briggs is very, very promising as well. But, oh my God, Obafemi. Just because maybe, because he is easily the least experienced of the three men involved. And yet, he is the one that I am thinking, wow, where does this guy's ceiling stop? How high does it go? Can't wait to find out. So that match was brilliant. That office chair spot was brilliant, man. So many bits of it were brilliant. Watch it if you haven't watched it. This is my like biggest recommendation if you haven't seen any of the matches I'm talking about, apart from the ones at Mania, obviously. But if you haven't seen anything else across WrestleMania weekend, watch the Obafemi match, because you'll probably have a network subscription anyway if you watch Mania. It's on there now. Go and watch Stand and Deliver and watch the second match. Also, watch the first match, which I'm going to talk about now, the opening tag match. It was like a lovely starter, a little hors d'oeuvre for the Obafemi, Dijak and Briggs match. This was the Wolf Dogs, Baron Corbin and Bron Breakker, talk about people with bright futures, versus Nathan Fraser and Axiom for the tag team titles. Since they first won the belts, Baron Corbin and Bron Breakker's matches have had a really unique feel, kind of unhinged and wild, like the perfect type of match for opening a show like this. And it makes them really unmissable too. You get the feeling that something's about to happen, maybe even go wrong at any given moment. And you feel like these two champions are barely hanging on because they've kind of got this runaway momentum that even they possibly can't keep control of. That's how the matches feel, and it's awesome. So then when they're matched against two ludicrously quick high flyers like Nathan Fraser and Axiom, that's only a recipe for further intensity and further thrills in the match itself. I'd have maybe liked to have seen this one get a bit more time, but I get that they were probably working on a tight schedule and it just made the pace even more furious, I suppose. So it was really good. If you haven't seen this or the Triple Threat, like I said, I absolutely recommend them both very, very highly indeed. Which, I mean, those are my two favourite matches on the show, which means we do slightly have a case of the show being overshadowed by its undercard. But I do want to mention the later matches as well. I've talked about the main event and how it was strangely simple. But the two title matches, the two singles big title matches, I think warrant mention as well. They were still very good, just maybe not as thrilling as those two opening bouts. So for the women's belt, we had Lyra Valkyria defending against Roxanne Perez. For the men's, we had Ilya Dragunov versus Tony D'Angelo. Both of these matches had a great sense of intensity and bitterness to them, particularly the women's match, which really felt downright nasty. Great work by both women in the feud building up to it. I'm not fully convinced yet by Roxanne Perez on the mic as a heel, but I am more than convinced by her as a heel in the ring. She really amazes me, Roxanne Perez. She's so young, but so experienced on the indies as Roxy. And she's just carried that into NXT. And I did not realize that, well, I realized that she was very accomplished as a babyface wrestler. I did not realize that she could just do the same as a heel instantly as well and just be brilliant at wrestling matches as the villain. Yeah, she's just as good a heel in the ring as she is a face. You'd think that being a face would be more natural to her, given her size, given her moveset, and given the way that she wrestled as a face. You know, you'd think that style lend itself only to being a face. Turns out she can adapt that moveset and adapt that style and infuse it with a real sense of maliciousness, which just comes across so well. Lyra was great in her role too. Again, people have been critical of her on the mic, although she may be the more comfortable of the two, the more natural sounding on the mic. But while I haven't necessarily been blown away by Lyra's character stuff, I think her reign is more than made up for that in its matches and has proven that she's, yeah, she's ready for the main roster kind of straight away, isn't she? So is Roxanne. We'll have to see whether one or both of them gets called up. I guess Roxanne will have her second title reign probably, but we'll see what happens with Lyra. If she got called up, I wouldn't begrudge her that at all. I think she fully deserves it. On the men's side of things, Tony versus Ilya was interesting. Like all of Ilya's title matches, they all seem to have like a basic floor. Not floor, F-L-A-W, like a basic floor, like a carpet. They all have a basic floor of very good. Like they're always very good or better because it's Ilya Dragunov matches and he constructs them and performs them to such an intense degree, you can't help but enjoy them. And this one was no different. Tony rose to the occasion as well. And I particularly enjoyed like the big set piece moments in this match. I love whenever Ilya drops that flying forearm. It always feels like a big moment. I love both of them agreeing to strip the announce table and to make, let's take this match to the next brutal level. I like that sort of stuff. But I do also find it interesting looking ahead, like what's going to happen next? Is the family going to turn on Tony D? Stax wanted Tony to cheat, didn't he? He wanted him to use the brass knuckles and Tony said no. It's all very interesting, but it will play out on weekly NXT. So there's no exact guarantee that it'll actually, you know, make sense or like any sense at all. And like I said at the top of this segment, that's kind of the theme of NXT. The weekly stuff is so hit and miss and way more often miss than hit. But they continue to just knock it out of the park at these big showcase events. So on one hand, NXT is kind of doing its job perfectly. Well done, Shawn Michaels, because he's managed to collect and develop this insane talent that represents the very future of WWE. But at the same time, as a show itself, as a brand itself, I always find the TV stuff so far removed from the PLEs and such a ludicrous acid trip of a weekly show that I just don't know whether NXT is succeeding or flopping massively. It's a weird one. Like, functionally it works, but as its own standalone thing, it's not that good. Like, there's lots of unintentional hilarity, I suppose, but in terms of real quality, in terms of the week-to-week storytelling, it's bad. But it all comes together when there's a big PLE. I don't understand it. It baffles me. I don't know why they don't keep it, like, more simple, like the old NXT, presented, you know, as more of a traditional territory-type show rather than whatever the hell Sean and co. keep writing it as week after week. But save the more high-concept stuff for the main roster, keep the stories down there very simple, and keep the PLEs exactly as they are, because more often than not, they're the ones that succeed. And that's no exception. Last weekend, we saw an excellent Stand and Deliver. Apart from that main event, which was still a good match, just not what they'd built it up to be on TV. Weird one. Anyway, NXT is weird. Part of me wouldn't want to change it, I guess, because it's just so downright strange. That's enough of the whole WWE stuff. I will now talk about some different promotions across WrestleMania weekend, although it's been a bit of a strange one, hasn't it? Last year, I feel like I covered a way broader amount of promotions that seemed like there was excellent matches popping up all over the place. Whereas this year, this felt like WWE's WrestleMania weekend, as silly as that sounds. But, you know, indie fans out there will know that WrestleMania week isn't just about WWE. It's about everything going on. It's this big carnival of wrestling. This year, it was like WWE reclaimed the week. And as such, this section, or the next couple of sections, might be a bit shorter than all the WWE stuff I've just talked about. But there's still plenty of matches to go, so let's press on and let's talk about Supercard of Honor.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Looking to butterfly the arms. Mark Briscoe! Goodness! We do not understand the things we must read and react to are often larger than us. Tonight, there was something divine that pushed Mark Briscoe across the finish line, becoming for the first time Ring of Honor World Champion.
Ring of Honor pay-per-views are weird these days, aren't they? AEW gets all the attention from Tony Khan, and rightly so, it's his promotion. But it feels like he's not really devoted enough, I don't know whether it's people in charge or enough attention to or resources towards Ring of Honor, which is a tremendous shame because, you know, throughout the 2000s, Ring of Honor was the king of indie wrestling. Everyone loved Ring of Honor. I'm too young to really remember it in its heyday, but I've been reliably informed, and the stuff I've gone back and watched has reliably also informed me, that it was, like, in many ways, like the pinnacle of indie wrestling. And nowadays, it's just an absolute shadow of its former self, and that is very sad. This event had some great matches, though, and where else could I begin but by talking about Eddie Kingston versus Mark Briscoe for the Ring of Honor World Championship. I do have mixed thoughts right off the bat, because on one hand, Mark Briscoe winning the Ring of Honor World title is such a powerful payoff to what should be such a powerful story. Mark Briscoe going for the belt that his brother held in the past, but that he himself has never been able to win. And then not only doing it for himself, but doing it for the memory of Jay Briscoe as well. That's fantastic stuff. And that is what we saw happen, to be fair. And the family was there in the front row. And, you know, he had a great opponent in the form of Eddie Kingston. I can't complain about any of that. Obviously, the match was great. Mark played it heavily in it as well, which I'm not sure if the story even needed to get more dramatic, but it certainly added to the intensity and the brutality of the match. He played it a lot. Like, it looked brutal. And the match was great as well, as you'd expect from a match featuring Eddie Kingston and Mark Briscoe. Even in normal circumstances, that would be a banger of a match, let alone the main event of a pay-per-view in such an emotional extra added context as well. But there are two drawbacks that I do have to mention, and I hate having to mention them, but I'm going to. Number one, and this is by far the more minor of the two drawbacks, but I thought maybe the crowd would be like way more into this than they were, or than they seemed. I don't know if it's because they were burnt out after such a long action-packed show, or maybe the production just didn't pick up the excitement of the crowd well enough. I'm not certain. But for whatever reason, it felt, at least watching from home, like the atmosphere wasn't quite as consistently there throughout the match as I would have expected it to be. And then the second problem, and this is by far the bigger one, and maybe it feeds into the first, the second problem is the build. Like, what the hell, Tony Khan? You know, like, as I alluded to before, this whole general neglect of Ring of Honor has been a major negative on Tony's resume as a wrestling promoter since he bought the company. I know he's always emphasized that it's a separate company from AEW and stuff, maybe implying that he's not fully in charge of it. And I do think he should delegate it and leave it in the hands of people who have the time to do so, because he's busy with AEW. But you know, something's not working. I don't know what it is. I don't know if he's not prioritizing it enough or pushing it heavily enough. This storyline, or the relative, I guess, neglect of this particular storyline, is perhaps the biggest and worst example of this neglect. If ever a storyline deserved a huge, featured, emotional build, it was surely this one, Mark Briscoe finally getting the title. And all we got on AEW TV was the pair of them cutting a backstage promo alongside Adam Copeland. And the promo was Adam Copeland's promo. He was calling out the House of Black. And then, as like an aside, Briscoe and Kingston went, oh, and by the way, we're going to have a really good match with each other and we're going to give it our all at Supercard of Honor. Yeah. And then they went back to the whatever Adam Copeland was talking about. And I thought, what? This should be like a huge deal, right? I don't know. I was about to say maybe they did it more to build it on Ring of Honor TV. But the fact that neither Eddie Kingston nor Mark Briscoe have been regulars on Ring of Honor for quite a long time now also adds to my bemusement, I guess. And also the fact that the Ring of Honor World Championship has been tied up in this Triple Crown that Eddie only recently started to lose. So on your Ring of Honor, on the Ring of Honor brand, neither guy main eventing Supercard of Honor was a regular on the show for the past few months, at least. The belt's not even been around. And this big emotional storyline did not get the time that it deserved, either on Ring of Honor or on AEW, which would have helped promote Supercard more effectively. Baffling stuff. Neither of the wrestlers fought, and they at least delivered in the match itself, which was very good. Great match, possibly held back a little bit from its full potential because of the build, or non-build, because there really wasn't one. That was good anyway. That was very good. And I'm delighted to see Mark Briscoe finally hold the Ring of Honor World Championship, albeit in tragic circumstances. The state of Ring of Honor, of Ring of Honor at the minute also has meant for a long time now that the women's division has had to carry a considerable load, specifically the Ring of Honor Women's World Champion, Athena, and she has done so brilliantly. She was in the co-main event here against Hikaru Shida, and I've got a confession to make, okay? I'm not saying that I think Hikaru Shida's overrated. I'll just say that she's never clicked with me as much as she seems to have with many, many other people. Even during her big AEW title reign. She's just never quite, I don't know whether it's the way her matches are typically constructed or what. Okay, it sounds like maybe I am saying she's overrated in my opinion. I can see that she's trying, she's giving it her all, and she's getting all this praise from most people, so I doubt she really cares what like one person thinks that she doesn't know. But for some reason, it's just never fully clicked with me. I don't know, actually, maybe if that's something that's kind of happened in the past few years, where since I've been becoming more familiar with Stardom, I just feel like there's a boatload of Japanese women's wrestlers out there who are so much more sharp, or seem so much more sharp and complete in the ring. Not that that makes Hikaru Shida a bad wrestler, far from it. I'm just trying to say that like the bar has been set so high by so many others, and so many of her peers. Anyway, this was a good match, but again, I just found myself enjoying Athena's performance far more than I was enjoying Shida's performance. Athena didn't drag Shida to having a great match or anything, but Athena's been so consistently good for so long that I reckon this problem would have happened kind of almost regardless who she was facing. You just find yourself watching Athena and thinking, wow, she's got it all. She's doing everything here. And her opponent's kind of also occasionally doing some cool stuff. And I don't just mean Athena's offense, which is brilliant, but I mean that when she's selling, when she's making her opponent look good, you can't help but think she's very good at making her opponent look good, not, wow, her opponent looks good. You know what I mean? Like, it's all Athena, man. She's way too talented for her own good. She won a very action-packed bout here that was still very enjoyable despite everything I've just said there. And it also demonstrated the full range of her heel champion abilities. She was shocked at Sheeta's resilience. She was demonstrating cowardice, ruthlessness, rule breaking. She's the total package, man. She's a brilliant heel champion. And that's, honestly, that's no surprise. She has been this excellent for as long as I've been watching her, certainly, and probably for ages before I was aware of her as well. Athena's brilliant. I'm a bit of a shameless fanboy for her. I do appreciate Hikaru Shida, and I'm worried that I've been a bit harsh on her there, because she did come to play in this match, like The Miz. No, she came to play in this match. She held up her end of the bargain, and they put on a very, very good co-main event. But it wasn't the only women's match on the show that I really liked. There was a match for the inaugural Women's TV Championship, like the first ever Women's TV Champion, and it was Billy Starks, kind of the protege of Athena, but a babyface one, against Queen Aminata. This had quite a low cage match rating when I was just kind of browsing the shows that I'd watched over WrestleMania week. And I was very confused by that because I enjoyed this. Then it kind of dawned on me, oh, people didn't like this match because they did a worked injury angle at the end of it or towards the end. So what happened was Queen Aminata was kind of dominating the match and targeting Starks's like head and neck. Then Starks hit, I think, like a swanton kind of move from the top and stayed down. Even though she was the one hitting the move, she was down flat on her back on the canvas, immediately signaled to the ref. You could hear her saying like, oh, my neck. The ref ran over and it became quickly apparent that Billy was injured. They brought the doctor in the ring. They cut to the commentators who had like their serious faces on and they fit a neck brace on her. And I think this annoyed a lot of people. I saw a lot of people saying, well, this is disgusting. I hate when they do work shoot injury angles in matches, which I get on one hand, but if you watch this back, I think they played it fine. I didn't find it offensive. What happens after that is they fit the neck brace to Billy Wright, and then they do something they would never do if she'd really hurt her neck. They lift her into a sitting position. Then they stand her up and help her hobble towards the ropes. She's going to exit the ring through the ropes. If she was really injured, they would like keep her flat and surely get her out onto a stretcher under the bottom rope. So when that started happening, maybe that's why I wasn't offended by it, but I just felt like, oh, it's a work shoot. This is going to be great. So I really enjoyed it, but people seem to have hammered it for this online. I liked it and I didn't think it was in poor taste because I thought it was clearly part of the storyline. Don't know if that makes me heartless. But yeah, they walk her over to the ropes. It's clearly a very wrestling thing that's going on. Queen Aminata sits on the middle rope and like holds the ropes open to help her get out. And when she's turned her back, Billy Stark grabs her. I think there's like a German suplex into a sleeper or something. She chokes Queen Aminata out and wins the match and becomes the inaugural Ring of Honor TV champion. I thought that was cool. Some people did not. I'll be interested to see going forwards what Billy's going to be like as a heel. And also, wow, even though she lost the match, Queen Aminata is quality. I really need to watch more of her stuff. I've been very impressed by her occasional AEW appearances, but this match definitely made me a much bigger fan of hers instantly. She was brilliant because for much of the match, until she got screwed at the end, she was the dominant one. She was in control. She hits this amazing kick where her like half of her body flies through the ropes and she catches herself on them and then like poses or does a great facial expression towards the camera. She's brilliant. And I can't wait to see more. The other match I want to mention from Supercard was the opener, Kyle Fletcher versus Big Shotty Lee Johnson for the Men's TV Championship. This was a great opener. You could say maybe that, you know, they hit every move under the sun and kicked out of most of them. But when it's a fast-paced show opener and it's two ludicrously talented wrestlers, as Fletcher and Johnson both are, and when they're executing everything so sharply and so flawlessly, it's hard to complain too much about, you know, psychology and stuff like that. There were elements of psychology, good ring psychology in this match, obviously. It was just done at quite a super indie kind of rate. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was so clean. Some of the stuff these guys were pulling off without a flaw was just amazing to see. It didn't have like the emotion or the story behind it that many other matches that I preferred across WrestleMania week did. But in terms of an athletic performance, it was hard to top. One thing I want to mention, does anyone know why Kyle Fletcher keeps kicking out of everything so much? Kyle Fletcher will not die. it was evident in that match with Ospreay on AEW Dynamite, where Ospreay hit him with a poison rod from the top, then a hidden blade, which is now Ospreay's kind of finisher, isn't it? And Kyle kicked out. And I thought, oh, well, maybe in that instance, Ospreay just wanted to let his real-life pal kick out of a lot of moves. Fair enough. But then in this match, he was kicking out of everything as well. And I thought, right, what does this mean then? Because I don't for one second think that Fletcher's backstage going, yeah, mate, I kick out of everything. That's what I do. This seems like a conscious decision from AEW / Ring of Honor to have Fletcher kick out of all these moves in his matches. What I mean by that is it feels like they are positioning him to possibly be something important for them in the future. We'll have to wait and see, but Kyle Fletcher could be a major deal. He's certainly got the work rate for it, and I'll be very interested to keep an eye on him and see where he stands. Let's say, like, even just 1 year from now. We'll have to wait and see. But yeah, he's got all the promise in the world. I think he's still very young, and he can wrestle his balls off. Right, that was Ring of Honor Supercard of Honor. Now let's talk about everything else. Let's do a bit of a sweep and talk about the best matches from all the other promotions here, there, and everywhere across Philadelphia. And I'll cherry pick my favorite matches from that group. This is the final part of the show, and it's called Other. And when you've got such a high concentration of great wrestlers in one city at one time, it's impossible, you know, for no great matches to come out of it. You will find some. And I did. And the king of the indies last weekend was probably a man that you may have heard of called Speedball Mike Bailey, who I think, across just a few days, had 10 wrestling matches, which is absolutely ludicrous. And upstairs, some of the guys in the office were saying, oh, I think in other years he's had more than 10. So Speedball's really made this his mission over the past few years to kind of wrestle all the matches he can at WrestleMania weekend. And this year was no exception. And it paid off. I'll mention a few now. He wrestled Masha Slamovic of TNA and other promotions. She's brilliant. And they had a good match at the Wrestling Revolver and House of Glory joint show. It was intense. It was fast. It was competitive. I don't think I've ever quite seen this side of Bailey in a match as well. Certainly not right from the off, right from the start of a match. He attacked Slamovic before the bell. I've seen matches where he's ramped up the intensity down the stretch, and that's been thrilling to watch. But yeah, he attacked her from the opening bell in quite heelish fashion. And I was like, what's going on here? And credit to the commentary team, which I think was Vader Scott and Filthy Tom Lawler, who did a good job of providing context. Apparently, Bailey has failed to beat Masha Slamovic on several previous occasions. So in this one, he was quite desperate and willing to bend the rules from the start. It also had a very unique venue. This show took place in like a church hall. Looked very different, looked very cool. I like when wrestling shows take place in distinct venues. Masha obviously is great and has had a real breakout year or two over the past couple of years, really. And she's an absolute asset for TNA and the Knockouts division and whichever other promotion she appears in as well. And she got the win here. Bailey will continue his quest to beat Masha Slamovic because she got the win here with a sick pile driver on the apron, which was nice to see. Another speedball match that I really enjoyed was the main event of DDT's WrestleMania weekend show. Mike Bailey versus Yuki Ueno, the champion currently in DDT. And I think I slightly preferred the match with Masha Slamovic. But this was very good too. It was the main event of DDT's show, as I say, and I think it was supposed to be a mixture of like a high work rate match and a match where it's like, look how strong and resilient our champion is. But I don't know if that backfired slightly, because my thought process coming out of this match was, wow, Bailey's really good, isn't he? Like, I was paying way more attention to Speedball, and I've seen way more Speedball matches already in my life than I've seen Yuki Ueno matches. So that was a bit of a shame for Ueno. But they both put in great performances. I mean, I've known for a long time how good Speedball is. I remember in the WCPW days, watching him have a banger of a match live against Will Ospreay in our World Cup tournament that we did. He is an incredible talent. But this match kind of helped me realize that maybe he's a bit more versatile than I thought he was as well. We saw him as this desperate, you know, kind of heelish figure searching for a win against Masha Slamovic. And then here against Yuki, we saw him as this kind of domineering, cocky pseudo-heel, although this was very much a face-versus-face match. But Bayley was kind of playing the heel role here. The first, like, half of the match, almost, was Bayley just battering the champion of DDT. Then it was on Yuki to come back into the match and eventually win down the stretch, and the crowd really got into it down the stretch and everything. But all the groundwork seemed to be put in by Bayley, and he excelled in that role, despite being like the most natural babyface wrestler you're ever going to see. So that was very interesting. If there's one thing I learned, I guess, over this WrestleMania weekend, it's that Speedball Mike Bayley is a very versatile man. The next match I want to mention is from Josh Barnett's Bloodsport, and it features Speedball Mike Bayley. Taking on Nick Nemeth, the former Dolph Ziggler. Wow. I'm assuming you might know what the Bloodsport event is. It's become one of the more famous indie events every WrestleMania weekend. But if you don't know, it's a shoot-style event. So you've got a ring, but with no ring ropes, and it's like knockout or submission only. There's no pinfalls. The matches do not typically feel like standard wrestling matches. They become like a worked MMA fight. You might think, what on earth was Dolph Ziggler doing in such an environment? In fact, the only time I've seen Nick Nemeth in this sort of situation was during the short-lived and very terrible Raw Underground. So I was interested to see how he did, and I thought he equipped himself really well here. I like the dynamic between the two as well. Bailey's this striker. Nemeth has this amateur wrestling background. And I liked the theme of the match as it progressed throughout, with Nemeth continually accidentally, but on purpose, knocking Speedball off the side of the ring, only for Speedball eventually to just come back in the ring, lose his temper, and boot Nemeth in the head. That was really cool to see. There was a nice struggle over a Speedball armbar attempt with a sense of real drama to it, because at Bloodsport events, submissions can happen at any point. And then Nemeth won with the sleeper hold. He had the sleeper locked in, then hit a zigzag, which sounds ludicrous in the Bloodsport context. One of the commentators had to kind of stifle a laugh as well when he hit it, and they kind of went, zigzag? At a Bloodsport event? That was what the tone of his voice said to me anyway. But it actually worked, because Nemeth altered the way he usually delivers that move. He didn't jump up really high and land light as a feather like he would in WWE. This had lower elevation. It just felt sharper and more like a real slam down to the canvas. Then he reapplied the sleeper and got the win. It was pretty short, as most Bloodsport matches are, but it was still really enjoyable. There's one other Bloodsport match I want to mention as well before we move on. It was the derby the rivalry match between tag partners and best friends, Fuminori Abe versus Takuya Nomura. They had a match last year, was it? Or was it earlier this year? God, I can't even remember now. But this is the second match between these two in recent memory. Second singles match between these two. They've been on an unbelievable run as an excellent tag team for the past few years. And now they're starting to have great matches against each other, which is fun. Now, weirdly, of all the matches at this Bloodsport event, this was like the most, like, standard wrestling match, which sounds crazy, but like these guys were selling more than in the other matches. There were more pauses than in the other matches. It's still a shoot style wrestling match, but it's also kind of, I'll say it like this. It felt like a strong style wrestling match verging on a shoot style wrestling match, whereas the other bouts on this show, it was like they were trying to simulate a real fight. This one was more performative. It was more pantomimey, but not as much as you'd find at a normal wrestling show, but just a little bit in that direction, if that makes sense. It's quite surprising that the Dolph Ziggler match was more realism-based than the one featuring two strong-style Japanese guys, isn't it? But that's exactly what happened, and this was excellent. It was my favourite match of Bloodsport. It was possibly my favourite, like, non-big promotion match of the weekend, actually. They sort of tailored their usual game just a little bit, and it was perfect for this sort of environment. Both guys having little flurries and little sequences that didn't require using any ring ropes, so it just worked for Bloodsport. Just strikes and counters and submissions and the occasional bit of one-upmanship and posturing. And yeah, astronauts forever. They are an amazing tag team and now amazing opponents. I loved it. And Takuya got the win. And I think that Abe got the win last time around. So hopefully we have a rubber match, unless there has been one and I've just forgotten. Oh, and I can't forget to mention as well, even though his match lasted just a few minutes and he was beaten quite quickly, I've got to give a shout out to Big Lou Nixon, the Northeast Zone, a local boy, a man who nearly kicked my head off at a North wrestling show once, but I was saved by Liam Slater, which was very kind of him. Lou Nixon, right, is like, he has real fighting pedigree, but he is also kind of a deathmatch guy as well. If you're from where I'm from, it's so authentic, man. You can just tell that he's a hard man. Like, you can just tell that he's scary. He's a lovely guy in real life, but you can just tell, oh, this guy means business and you don't want to mess with him. He looks like a fighter. And he started to make waves in America, which is very exciting for him indeed and fully deserved. He came out for this match at Bloodsport, right, to the song Won't Forget You, but like a dance remix of a sort of, right? So you're not going to understand if you're not from the north of England, okay? But there's this type of music that is popular in the north of England, and specifically the northeast, where both I and Big Lou Nixon are from. And it sounds so ludicrous to an outsider, but it's like a... Oh, I don't know how to describe it, man. It's like a hype song. Is that what Americans would say? Gets people energetic and jumping around and stuff. It's like an innocuous, sort of pleasant sounding, sped up dance music. You know, like, but it's what gets played out of a phone on the bus, and you think, oh, there's some troublesome teenagers behind me on the bus playing this song through their tinny phone speakers. And it's what you'd like hear in a park if there's a group of youths drinking. But it's like the sound of our childhood up here as well, you know? Lou Nixon came out to a song that sounded exactly like that. And even though it's a fairly recent song, took me, and judging by my social media, many other people back to their childhood in the northeast of England and across the north. And he came out to it and the Americans had no clue what was going on. It was brilliant. It was so good. There was one guy in the crowd, clearly from somewhere up here, who was losing his mind. And the commentators went, oh, that guy loves this song. Then Lou comes out. And the announce team goes, you know, it takes a certain kind of guy to come out to a song like that, and you just know that he's so intimidating. And I thought, are they trying to say the song sounds soft, but he's like a big, tough guy? Because over here, that sort of song means trouble. And it was really fitting. I loved it. I was sadly lost, and I was shamelessly rooting for Big Lou. Right, there you have it. That was my little recap of WrestleMania week and the best matches of WrestleMania week. I'd better do a top 10, shan't I? Here we go. At number 10, Ilya Dragunov versus Tony D'Angelo for the NXT Championship. Number 9, the Wolf Dogs versus Nathan Fraser and Axiom for the NXT Tag Team Championship. Number 8, for the US title, Logan Paul versus Randy Orton versus Kevin Owens. Number 7, Eddie Kingston versus Mark Briscoe for that Ring of Honor World Championship. Number 6, Bayley versus Io Sky for the WWE Women's Championship. Number 5, that Bloodsport match I just talked about, Fuminori Abe versus Takuya Nomura. Tag partners turned rivals, excellent stuff. Number 4, it had to be on here, even though I didn't fully agree with everything in it, but as a moment, what a moment. Roman Reigns versus Cody Rhodes in the main event of WrestleMania. What more can you say? Some people will have that as their number one, and I couldn't blame them. Number 3, Gunther versus Sami Zayn for the IC Championship. Number 2, Seth Rollins versus Drew McIntyre for the World Heavyweight Championship. And number 1, for the bloody North American Championship in NXT Stand and Deliver, Uber Femi versus Dijak versus Josh Briggs. Quite a few of these matches have now slotted into my overall top 10 of 2024 so far. I'll read them out now. At number 10, Roman Reigns versus Cody Rhodes. Number 9, Gunther versus Sami Zayn. Number 8, Seth Rollins versus Drew McIntyre. It's all WrestleMania so far. Number 7, Kazuchika Okada versus Bryan Danielson from Wrestle Kingdom. Number 6, Darby Allin versus Konosuke Takeshita on Dynamite. Excellent, best kind of shortish match of the year so far. Number 5, Obafemi versus Dijak versus Josh Briggs. The best match of this year's WrestleMania weekend for me. And now, number 5 in my ongoing best of 2024 list. Number 4, Bryan Danielson versus Zack Sabre Jr. 2. Number 3, the United Empire versus the War Dogs in New Japan. Number 2, Sting and Darby Allin versus the Young Bucks, aka Sting's retirement match. And number 1, and still for now, my match of 2024 from AEW Revolution, Will Ospreay versus Konosuke Takeshita. So there you have it. Thank you very much for listening to my inane ramblings. I will be back at the end of April to talk about all the other matches that happened in April not involving WrestleMania week. Could there be some matches from AEW Dynasty? We'll have to wait and see, but I strongly suspect that yes, there will. Thank you very much for watching, or for listening, excuse me. I hope you've had a wonderful WrestleMania week as well, and do let me know what you thought. If you were there, if you went to any of the shows, or if you watched any from home and have any other match recommendations to give me, either from WrestleMania week or from around the wrestling world, do tweet me at JackTheJobber. Thanks for listening. I'll see you very soon.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.